I'll say it like this time. We had our chance for reform, and that was Barack Obama. And that was the last chance for reform. Now, Occupy Wall Street, this is a revolution. Whether we know it or not, this is a revolution. Because we are tired of the people, the 1% of the 1%. And what they have done to the country, what they've done to the world. Government is finished. It's not going to work. I don't care who we vote for, who we put into office. They're bought and paid for before they get there. This is absolutely a revolution. Because now everybody realizes that we're slaves to debt. We're slaves to isms and schisms. We're slaves to people's ideology. We're slaves to people who are intractable in their thinking, where they believe. But you got people in this country who believe we're free and know damn well we're not. How in the hell can the Marines go to Iraq, serve two tours, and then can't come back and stand on the street in Oakland? If you can't do that, you have to have a revolt.
Welcome to the Occu Podcast for Tuesday, February 14th, 2012. I'm Dennis Treanor Jr., your host. Today, I had a visit with two organizers behind Occupy Harvard. Darren Corman is a teaching fellow in visual and environmental studies, and Hannah Hoffens is a doctoral candidate at the Harvard Divinity School, both organizers with Occupy Harvard. In the fall, they're in the unusual position of camping physically outside in Harvard Yard, withstanding the scorn and derision of undergraduates that they would later go to teach in classes later that day. And as recently as Sunday night, Occupy Harvard reoccupied a physical space on Harvard campus, specifically the Lamont Library Cafe. I spoke with them at length today. Security is very tight on the campus of Harvard University. I could not get a pass, and I could not get into the Lamont Library, even though normally guests are allowed in with students. We did retreat after the Harvard Occupy Harvard think tank this afternoon. We did retreat to a private space at the Harvard Divinity School to have the following conversation. Enjoy. Tomorrow, Thursday the 15th, check back in with the Occu Podcast as I talk with Susie Cagle, who's been covering the Occupy Oakland protest since day one, the most in-depth coverage I've seen there. Later in the week, we also have Glenn Ford from the Black Agenda Report, and we also have David DeGraw from Occupy Wall Street. But for now, enjoy this conversation with Hannah and Darren from Occupy Harvard.
It's been a long afternoon. I'm with Darren and Hannah of Occupy Harvard, which has recently reoccupied public space in the Lamont Library on the Harvard Yard, a building to which I was denied entry on several attempts today. So we have run back to the Divinity School space to conduct this interview. First of all, tell us a little bit about the reoccupation of Harvard, how that came to be, and you know what confrontations you had, and where it stands right now. Mm-hmm.
Well, so we've never stopped occupying Harvard, but we did reoccupy physically, which is nice because we have a space and people are home and people are sleeping together and people are talking together again, which is the hard part of not having a space. So when Harvard announced 3 weeks ago, maybe somewhere around then, that they were moving forward with the library reorganization plan, they told the room of workers that there would be significant voluntary and involuntary cuts in the workforce. This was news to everybody, and it raised all kinds of red flags and alarms. And as soon as more non-information was shared by administration about these plans, it became clear that this whole process is one that's being driven by certain corporate interests for the benefit of Harvard Corporation, not for the benefit of Harvard libraries as a site of learning and knowledge and public good. So at that point, Occupy Harvard people such as myself and others said, we care and we stand with the library workers and we stand in the libraries as a place that matters for us and for our future and for our society.
So you're now sleeping in the library and you're a student at the university.
I am.
Yeah. And so how long have you been in the library now? So you mentioned before in the walk over here that this is your first time out of the library. How long?
We occupied Sunday. It was a quiet occupation. We went in gradually and took over an expanding amount of space. So we've been there. This is our second full day, 2.5 days now, and that is good.
Darren, you mentioned some interesting free speech issues that came up in relation to the recent physical occupation in the library. Can you talk about those a little bit?
Yeah, of course. And Sunday, when we moved in slowly, we also brought signs and some banners regarding both the library situation in terms of layoffs that said no layoffs or no cuts and a couple other things, but also just general Occupy signs, Occupy Knowledge, Occupy Everywhere, Think Tank, and what have you.
Right.
And the Monday morning, late morning, around 11, I think, the police came in, and the police was there from Sunday night, and they stayed overnight. And the police came in along with the building security chief, I believe, and I might be wrong about his position because he denied us that privilege when we asked who he was.
Sorry, are these campus police or are these Cambridge police?
Campus police.
Yeah.
HUPD. And they said that we need to remove the signs that are attached to the building, that being the banner and a tracing paper on the windows that we projected signs on and our image of a dome on, the dome that was previously taken from us. And so there was this long argument with them for about 15 minutes, for which I was there, but I edited the video for, so I saw it quite a few times by now, where one of Occupy Harvard people, Andrew, repeatedly asks them, how does such an unwritten policy, as they mentioned it is, of not having signs in the library work with the general university policy of free speech, which also comes with enforcement items within the policy that says anybody who restricts free speech will be suspended for a year. And their answer was, take those signs down. And I'm not joking. it was that person, the chief, looking at Andrew, then turning to the police and saying, he can answer it, and then the police saying, take those signs down. And this went about maybe 6 times over and over again, after which they told us that we should take them down, otherwise the custodians who will take them down might damage the signs. We said, okay, and didn't take them down. And so they took them down, but the custodians that might damage the signs turned out to be the very police that told us that they might be damaging the signs that would be beyond their control, etc. So it was a bit of an absurd theater for our morning. So that's what happened. I mean, it was kind of like a token free speech policy issue. But
I think there are still some signs up attached to the building in some way.
So,
that's an important detail.
Yes. Since it was, I guess, infringing upon what they told us to, because during that time of 20 minutes or 15 minutes of repeatedly telling them, like, how is this working, they had told us explicitly 3 times that signs that are on the chairs are fine. They are not attached to the building. They're not taped. They're good. But then they took them away anyways. And then an hour later, they had to bring them back because we said, you took our property. Can you please bring it back? And eventually they did. So they are now back up.
Talk about your perspective individually about the importance of a physical occupation of space. You touched on it a little bit earlier, Hannah. But like you said, you know, correct me earlier, Occupy Harvard has been in existence since November. With or without a physical occupation.
Yeah.
So different cities or occupations are struggling with this, you know, identity post-eviction. You guys have retaken some space, but why is the physical occupation of space so important?
For me, Occupy is a call to be present. And it's a call for everybody to gather together and to wrestle and to argue and to engage and to connect as humans around the condition of our world, our future, and just what it means to be one with another in a most basic sense, which to me is the heart of governance, of society, of anything that we might hope to achieve as a country or world, a globe. And so what that space does is allow that to happen. When you don't have space, you have to manufacture moments of coming together. And the ways in which that manufacturing tends to occur is through actions, which are not open-ended, but that are drawing for a very particular purpose and in a very particular orientation. And that doesn't allow that plurality to take place, and it also doesn't allow the surprise that happens when the call is just to be present. See who you meet. When I would walk into Liberty Plaza and just, you know, meet new people. If I were there for a march, I would be walking next to people, but we would be talking about the march, typically. That's what we did. When I was standing there randomly drying my silkscreen shirt that I took off in order to get silkscreened, that was a very different conversation. And that cannot happen if you don't have a persistent home. Now, the question is, does it need to be overnight? I'm not sure. Does it need to be fully accessible? Absolutely. Does it need to be recognized as an agora, as a forum, as a political place? Definitely. And I think that is what really is threatening about it, because that is the very definition of politics, people working together.
What are the threats right now to the physical occupation in the library? Are you going to go back there and sleep tonight? What are you being threatened with, any kind of sanctions or disciplinary action from the university? Or what's the obstacles to maintaining that space?
Well, they threatened us. Basically, they gave us a rule sheet yesterday, which is, I don't even really know how to describe it as a rule sheet, because it's not really rules. Basically, what it says is, respect our authority or there will be punishment.
Just as an aside, I was following the Occupy Harvard Twitter yesterday, so I was under the mistaken impression that the Harvard students were very happy with all the rules they had created for themselves, just to let you know how I misread your Twitter feed. But you're saying no, you were kind of poking fun. Rules that were being handed to you.
It was nice, like a nice little pink sheet that says respect authority. That's what I've said in the third item.
Respect authority, respect the people who are entrusted to care for this space, which of course we do in the way in which that is actually meant. But what it means is respect us, respect what we say, do what we say, as a cop said when challenged about the policy. It doesn't matter what the policy is, do what he told you now or else. And then later, you can worry about whether or not it was right to do that or not.
Yeah,
but for now, you do what the cop or the administrator told you. No, that's not how I live. That's not how we, as the occupiers in Lamont, choose to live. We think that it's important that these things be thought about in advance. So the rules are respect authority or...
I like the last rule, which is that the Lamont Library is also bound by Commonwealth Massachusetts law, as if the rest of Harvard is somehow not, which sometimes it feels that it is not.
Well, it depends on who you are at any given time and the rest of Harvard, and I think that's definitely
Obviously true. That's going to be people's perception outside of Harvard. Who the hell are these 1% students think they are occupying Harvard, right? I mean, we joked on the way over here about, you know, maybe at another school, even an Ivy League school like Brown, it's almost a graduation requirement to participate in some kind of protest activity, but Harvard does not have that kind of tradition or reputation.
No.
So what is the response that you've been getting from your fellow students about your activities?
It's really mixed. There's a strong underground support for it, but the willingness to be present is not there on a wide scale. There's a lot of fear, the intimidation. So the consequences, I mean, it was, you could be arrested if you don't respect our authority. You will come up against the university sanctions. You will lose your library privileges, which, of course, is a very direct threat, particular to those of us who are in the library and who are saying the library is the most important thing to us, in a sense, right now.
Right.
That works. Harvard knows what it's doing when it's issuing these framing notions. Undergrads have not been enthusiastic about Occupy at all. There certainly are pockets, and there are individuals who surface. There's a really strong level of peer pressure, and there's a great op-ed actually this week that talks about that in the Crimson, around what's at stake in being an undergrad and supporting Occupy, and why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you do that? Because of various pressures that are laid out upon you. The graduate students.
Talk about some of those pressures. What are the pressures laid against an undergraduate at Harvard that she or he wouldn't come out and support?
So, well, the op-ed basically came down to the notion Occupy is vulgar. It doesn't play by the rules of a good modern society for effecting change. We don't send out nice emails and network online in a pretty fashion. We sit in ugly tents in the middle of the yard and say, you need to come and actually deal with your fellow human beings, messiness and all. And not just the human beings you want to, not the ones who are smart enough, not the ones that you agree with, and not the ones who can get into this space, but you need to deal with human beings, which means all that that means.
Right.
And that's really hard within the Harvard mentality, where you've been cultivated and groomed to be the best of the best and to position yourself in a richly deserved way often, but also in a very problematic way. And to me, that needs to be occupied. That's part of the reason I occupy Harvard. It's to occupy the idea that you can be privileged in that sense and deserve it, because you can't.
You can't.
Be privileged as somebody who is smart enough, who has done enough, who has achieved enough, that you don't have to deal with the messiness of society, and you don't need to get dirty with the rest of us.
One of the victories that Occupy claims in its first 4 months of existence is, if you can call it a victory, changing the national conversation about wealth and equity.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying it's more difficult at Harvard to have that conversation? Because if you're more often than not, one would assume, correct me if I'm wrong, the people doing the introspection are doing so from a place high on top of a hill, looking down.
I mean, not only that, but also these are people who have been kind of cultured after they have come or before they have come to the university to target being one of the 1%.
Mm-hmm.
So not everybody who comes to Harvard is 1%. That's a very big illusion. A lot of people are from very, very different economic backgrounds. But it is true that Harvard harbors and kind of festers a culture that tries to like shoot you up to 1%, whether that is in an economical term or as a managerial sort of like hierarchy of power term. So, you know, people can work for NGOs and perhaps not become the 1% in a financial sense, but they are still top level. And again, to go back to your question of like why maybe there is so much dissent, is that to come to Harvard as an undergrad, which is very different than the graduate process, you have to almost be compliant. I mean, I'm sure they have a quota of like the rebel kids that come in with like dyed hair, but the majority of students.
The admissions office has a dyed hair checkbox.
It's possible. One for green, one for pink, one for, yeah. But, you know, you have to be fairly compliant in terms of achieving high standardized test scores, having been to Model United Nations or something in your high school, and demonstrate the CV of a successful entrepreneur. Entrepreneur in the sense of a student entrepreneur trying to sell myself to a college. So that comes with the being grown into compliance then comes, brings itself to the college where people are then compliant to whatever the college provides them. And Occupy is not what the college provides. Occupy is a disruptor. You know, we're throwing a wrench in the machine. And they don't like, I mean, nobody likes that. Because they're like, well, one example, when the yard got shut down, people were complaining just because they couldn't cut through their diagonals without reaching in their pockets and showing their IDs. That was a very big contention, as if it was some monumental...
For listeners who don't remember...
Sorry.
Go ahead and explain in November the response to the occupation of the yard.
After we occupied November 9th...
Before.
That's true. Before we set up the occupation November 9th, where we were having a rally that evening with a lot of people, hundreds of people, Harvard decided to shut its gates to the yard, to the main yard, as to not allow anyone in. And there was quite a bit of push and shove at the gates with the police in a physical sense. And after that, they shut the gates, didn't allow anyone in, didn't allow anyone out for a while. There was quite a few people from Harvard with IDs already in the yard, after which they have set up the tents. And you're in a better position to elaborate on that, because I was on the outside. Anyhow, they closed the yard, and then the yard remained closed for 44 days for anyone without a Harvard ID. And for a while, that included the people like at Extension School, because they don't have a Harvard ID, so they had to get like a privilege.
There's got to be some history about Harvard. I mean, that's kind of unprecedented.
It is.
Extremely. Harvard Yard has been occupied regularly since General Washington's troops occupied it during the Revolutionary War. Occupation is old tactics. It is not new. 10 years ago, there were hundreds of people camped out around the administrative building, around the Living Wage campaign. There was no lockdown. Somehow Occupy has struck a note of terror that other occupations have not. And I really am not sure, and I think that's something that, I mean, with the library, we're experiencing this as well. The response is so disproportionate, proactive, and weird, that clearly we're illuminating a real festering sore that needs to be brought forward. Why is this terrifying to you? And what does that mean about what we need to be working on as a whole community, administration, students, faculty, everyone?
Mm-hmm. Everyone has a different version of what they think victory might look like when you're inevitably in a rally or a march and you find yourself chanting that we are unstoppable, that another world is possible. What does that other world in your mind or in your mind look like? Mm. Or what are some characteristics of that?
I mean, to me, one of the most important, if not the important, again, for me, characteristics of Occupy is the transformative potential of the horizontal participatory space that it creates as it occupies, or one might call it unoccupy, as some of the Canadians do, because it's already occupied, colonialized.
Oakland had a similar debate.
Yeah. So that transformative potential for me is actually an enabler. In the infinite sense, in that the current society and its ossifying hierarchical structures allow for this kind of like stale, rigid democracies, quote unquote, that end up with the world looking like this, going into a crisis, economical, financial, and ecological, whereas the horizontal processes that occupy creates and provides are innately against that sort of staling or ossifying. There are still dangers, but as such, I think it provides a better ground for again, quote unquote, true democracy.
Mm-hmm. And I guess for me, I see victory every day. And the idea that, it's not just that another world is possible, it's that another world is amongst us every time we get together. And to me, the signs of victory are people seeing each other and people talking with each other in the deep senses of those words, not in the cursory sense. People who are not trying to market or consume, but who are saying, I want to live with you. And I want to live on this planet, and I want to make sure that's possible. And that's really, I think, the only future we can dream of that matters. And what that's going to look like is going to change from place to place and day to day in its particularities, But that fundamental bond between people and that love and just that connection and relationship is victory. And it happens every single day and every single moment. There's space for an occupation to take place. And how can that not give you hope, you know?
I'm going to shift a little bit and get your reactions to, a little inside baseball controversy that Chris Hedges launched on the Occupy World with his Cancer and Occupy article, right? So that my take on it is that his tone and even some of his journalism was a little unfortunate, a little condescending. And yet, even though he mistook Black Bloc for some kind of group and not a tactic, in my opinion, this movement can't tolerate a violent component. But violent anarchists don't have enough monopoly on anarchism either. So is that, I imagine, I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, that Occupy Harvard, it doesn't have to deal with people engaged in Black Bloc tactics in direct actions that I've seen coming out of Occupy Harvard. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But how does that debate resonate with an Occupy Harvard?
Occupy Harvard has Black Bloc, so I will correct that statement.
I'm happy to be correct.
But that being said, once again, the question is not Black Bloc. Black Bloc is something that I think we have to wrestle with what it means to be watched and to be present or to be anonymous and yet still be embodied. So you may be aware that in Boston, the Boston Police Force subpoenaed the Twitter accounts, and there is this current case that's going on. And you probably read the report from the last hearing where there was this interchange that apparently happened between the DA and the judge around the possibility of remaining anonymous on Twitter. And the DA was making the argument, well, this individual contracted with the company to express his or her thoughts. Therefore, this person gave up their rights to anonymity because of that contract with the company. And the judge says, well, anonymous speech is essential for a functioning democracy, and we've long defended that principle. So how in the 21st century are you supposed to have anonymous speech if not on the internet and if not through companies such as Twitter or such forums? And the DA says, well, I think I would go to Dewey Square and hand out leaflets.
Wearing a mask.
And, well, not yet. I would go to Dewey Square and hand out leaflets. And the judge, I wasn't there. I don't know the facial expressions. I only read the text. But I can imagine just was like, people watch you when you're in Dewey Square handling out leaflets. And there are more security cameras focused on that square than anywhere else in Boston right now, I think, or close to it. How exactly would that be anonymous? And the DA then said, I would wear a ski mask. So there's a real fundamental tension here about what it means to be people, bodies, gathered together, to be weighty, to be fleshy in that sense, and what it means to be able to escape the surveillance state that we live in so that you can dissent and so that you can effectively circumvent the controls on conversation that are in place. And Black Bloc and the ways in which that is inflamed, I think, is on that issue right there. Violence
separate
happens,
issue.
Separate issue. Violence happens with people in masks and not in masks. It happens in tents and outside of tents. It happens physically, emotionally, verbally, on all these different levels, inside occupations and out, directed towards security and police officers, and directed at the general public, and directed at occupiers themselves. That is a different set of problems that I think we need to engage on the level of relationship. And to say, if we're going to occupy together, if we're going to suggest that the world needs to be occupied, then we have to deal with violence as a relational problem. You're breaking the relationship when you act violently. You have betrayed the trust that is an occupying trust, in my sense, of being called together to work together.
Well, it depends on which occupation. Occupy Wall Street declared a commitment to nonviolence, and Occupy Oakland refused to or could not consent around what the definition was. So
right.
There, in some ways, there is in Oakland, there is no betrayal of that trust that you're referring to, because there is no central Occupy command that could set out right now
a
list of things that we can all consent to.
No, but I guess that's what I'm saying. You have to deal with it on that level of consensus.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is the relationship that you have to deal with it on, not on the level of banning a certain type of act. So in Occupy Oakland, it's not that you can say the trust is not to be violent. The trust is that we're going to engage in consensus, so we're not going to ban violence until everybody who's here gets to that point, and we need to engage in the consensus building work to get to that point. That's a responsibility that we have, and that's a challenge, and it's not easy, and it's hard. But if we believe another world is possible, and we believe that participatory processes can bring that about, then we should believe that our participatory processes can handle violence within our own ranks, and when to exclude it or when not to exclude it. And that's a radical proposal, but I believe it.
Do we need to grow, does the Occupy movement need to grow its numbers to become more effective?
Effective in what sense?
Effect change, reform or revolution. We haven't approached either one of those yet, in my opinion. We're affecting the dialogue, but we're not close to revolution, and we're maybe in revolt. And we haven't really affected any reforms yet. So before we even get to that debate, reform or revolution, we need to, in my opinion, grow our numbers. Would you agree with that? People who are actively participating in some way in Occupy, not physically
right.
giving up their home to go and live, but participating in the movement in a real, tangible sense.
I guess I would latch on to that last phrase, participating in the movement in a real, tangible sense. How do you put a number on that? And how do we know where the numbers are on Occupy? If it's a call and if it's a space to engage, then every time the discourse changes and every time there's a church in suburban America where they're having an after-church conversation on income inequality, is that not Occupy?
That's great. Okay. I'll grant you that. So I'm interested in this debate because I don't have a problem with Black Bloc or Black Clothes or Black Power or Black Panthers or Black anything. I'm interested in winning. So and what does that mean? What does that even mean? And it is almost laughable. How can you win? You know, is engagement in the present moment of a victory in and of itself, like you referred to. But even if we grant the moral and legal authority for people to act anonymously, and by anonymously wear all black and masks and things like that on the street, do those images, whether in real life or broadcast on the news, help us to grow the movement, or do they scare people away?
Having a bunch of dirty hippies in a park in New York City scared a bunch of people away. Those images are not friendly to the American aesthetic ideal. And it was precisely because they're not friendly, but that they persisted and people said, you know what? That doesn't matter. We're going to do this because we believe that being present matters more than any marketing campaign we could come up with. Sorry, Adbusters.
No,
but
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would say the same thing about the Black Bloc. We need to not be concerned with discourse, how it's already been framed around violence, and we need to not be worried about pictures and how we expect them to relate to the appropriate or acceptable aesthetic ideals of our values as a nation, but instead be true to what our true values are as a community committed to transforming the possibilities of living together in a way that allows all of us to live together. And that may mean that some of the pictures are distasteful, and that's fine. They always have been with Occupy. Let's not change that. We are not afraid to do something different, even if other people say that might not be the best thing to do. That's what we do best.
And, I mean, with the black or black block or without, the convenient images that it might provide to the media to, you know, milk the stereotypes that are built, hostile stereotypes that are built within the culture, they will always come up with hostile images to drive away people. I don't think the convenience of Black Bloc is enabling in a significant sense of the media to turn people away. And I think we just need to push with the reality of things, with the complexity of things, and to a degree ignore, just like we ignore the hierarchies that exist in terms of not making demands, those remnants of previous cultures that we did not create or have any real engagement with. You know, if you look at the Black Bloc, the violence done upon the Black Bloc is greater than the violence that might have happened by some members of the Black Bloc. It in itself is not a violent tactic. So I would say that it doesn't necessarily disable us from getting more people involved.
Final question, or talk about the ways in which Occupy Harvard is unique from Occupy Atlanta or Occupy in an urban center.
There's so many ways. From the most concrete, all of our occupations have been in enclosed spaces that are not public spaces or university property. So we are negotiating with institutions in a different sense than the occupations that are on public grounds. And that's a real source of questions that we wrestle with as an Occupy, as well as in our inter-Occupy activities, are constantly wrestling with. Most of us at Occupy Harvard are also active occupiers in Occupy Boston, Occupy Somerville, Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Oakland, everywhere. And that's also unique because it's a school, so we all have multiple homes and multiple communities that we belong to. We also, I say, are unique in that our locality, I mean, the localness of the Occupy Harvard movement, the ways in which we are true to what we're doing, we're occupying where we work directly. We're occupying our employer directly, not outside the doors. And that's a great opportunity, and it's a particular privilege of being a scholar. In some sense, that is my life calling, to be able to integrate that, and I'm endlessly thankful that that is afforded to me as an opportunity. In another sense, that's extremely difficult and requires a tremendous amount of integrity that I respect the Occupy Harvard people for taking on. To walk into a classroom and teach students that have been walking by your tents all night is a very different dynamic. Or when I walk into work this morning and have to answer to my boss, this time in a very happy way, for my participation in
Occupy. So as a PhD candidate, you have some teaching responsibilities, and you're teaching some people who would be hostile to you if they met you in an enemy camp.
Oh, absolutely so. And I'm also teaching people who are very, very supportive. But also people, so there's the idea of how do you teach, and I mean, because teaching's a hard, are we supposed to leave politics at the door in the school is a real question. Is a classroom a neutral space? I say flatly, no, that's impossible. We're embodied beings, education does something, we are producing knowledge that is effective and that directly transforms and has consequences. This is the reason why we, the walkout of the economics class, why we push on syllabus design and peer review and knowledge production techniques on the Harvard campus, out of that conviction. Education is never neutral. It is a political act. We are cultivating a society, and that is a tremendous gift and one that I believe in, but it's one that we need to be accountable for in a life-giving way. So there's that issue, but then there's also the power dynamics. I grade people. And so what are the dynamics for the people who report to me? I have a very supportive advisor. Other doctoral students do not. If you do not have a supportive advisor, you will not be at the Occupy Harvard camp because you would not be able to finish your program. the politics there are very few protections within that relationship. So that is unique. And like I said, it's something that I really respect Occupy Harvard occupiers for taking on and for telling advisors and employers and students and the people that they see daily in every possible capacity that, no, this is all related. And this is who I am, and this is what I stand for, and I do good work on all of these aspects, which is why I'm here. Mm-hmm. But I'm gonna be my full self and see how that goes.
And, you know, as a comparison point, you provided Oakland and New York and Boston, perhaps. As a university occupation, the locale that you occupy, the space that you occupy, also changes a lot in the terms that, A, you're coming from a much more homogenous body of people. You will and might have other people coming in from the outside, but that is not the same as having kind of like a random Gaussian gathering of people, which gives us both strengths and weaknesses. Also, as we occupy an educational space, and as most of us are engaged in education in one way or the other, and most of us are grad students, etc., who teach or in teaching positions, then also we raise a lot of questions about the production of knowledge and dissemination of knowledge and how the university systems reproduce the neoliberal hierarchies that our governments are modeled in which you as a student kind of come in here as almost a worker and you produce some knowledge and that knowledge is sort of taken from you and fed it to others after it's curated by this hierarchical system. There's some but very little peer-to-peer teaching, and to me that actually should be the primary mode of education if we're talking about education in the contemporary sense, because you know, we're not being educated to work in factories anymore. If we're coming to universities to watch lectures on physics, we can do that from home. So the university really needs to change its mode if it's going to be engaging the coming generations and stop saying things like, oh, these people are ADHD and therefore they cannot take
our lectures. That's right. So you admit a student body to a student-centered university to teach itself. David Graeber, who I don't know if you saw his response to Hedges,
yes.
Speaks very eloquently about parents or leaders' structures only being valid when they, by their very nature, subsume themselves.
Okay.
So, doctor cures a patient, I no longer have a power structure of you, I'm not needed anymore. Teacher, if she or he does their job well, no longer needed by the student. That's a radical idea for what Harvard can be. You know, I have a 12-year-old daughter and a 10-year-old son. I don't know if Harvard's going to change that by then to come to pass. But I do appreciate your time. Thank you very much, and I wish you the best of luck in continuing to occupy the library here at Harvard University.
Thank you.
Thank you.